All right. So the topic tonight in different forms is basically the admissibility of DNA evidence into a Beis Din, and in particular how it affected the Aguna cases of 9/11. This idea of new forms of evidence coming forward, it gets highlighted in a case like DNA, but the truth of the matter is there are a lot of things that we take for granted which the traditional sources really don't deal with in any way. So beyond the excitement of DNA evidence, something as simple as a voice recording is questionable whether or not it will be admissible into a Beis Din. Right? And come to traditional Jewish law, proof is very limited. There's documentary proof. Right? I can bring through a contract which has signatures of witnesses on that, and that is a standard form of proof. Of course, there is testimony, but there are very specific rules in terms of who has to deliver the testimony, how many people have to deliver the testimony, when it has to be delivered, etc. But beyond that, there's not a lot of talk of evidence in terms of a traditional Beis Din system. So things that we take for granted, audio tapes, videotapes, even a simple photograph, there is a question whether or not it will be admissible into a Jewish court of law. And if it is admissible, to what extent do we give it weight? Just for comparison, how would you compare a videotape to two witnesses? Is it as strong? Stronger? Right? Let's say two witnesses testify to something, and then I have a videotape that shows the exact opposite. Our gut feeling would probably be to go with the videotape. Right? That is correct. We know that there, if you look at modern cases, a lot of things that are standard, one has to just at first raise an eyebrow and say, well, no, wait a second, you know, to what extent do we believe this? Now, also we have to take a step back and realize to what extent can a photograph be forged, right? 10 years ago, if I spoke to you, I showed you a picture, you would believe it. Now everyone heard of Photoshop. And therefore, the value of photographic evidence has been knocked down a little bit. Since basically any 10-year-old with a computer, not a 30-year-old, but a 10-year-old, right, would be able to do this. The old Groucho Marx line, any fourth grader can read this. Get me a fourth grader. And so that becomes the truth in a lot of this, right? When it comes to splicing an audio tape, that which was so exciting at Watergate, you know, the missing time, any kid could do a better job with that nowadays. So one has to remember that as we are quick to accept new forms of evidence that at first on the face definitely seem to be as worthwhile or if not better than witnesses, as the technology gets better to a certain extent, at some point the believability perhaps becomes worse. Now, when we talk about DNA evidence, we lose track as to how modern this is. Right? Now that it's popular, now CSI is like on like 9 nights a week or so, right? Everyone assumes that this has been on forever, right? As long as Starsky and Hutch were around, they were doing this type of evidence. The truth of the matter is, DNA has been around forever. However, our knowledge of DNA has not been around forever. In fact, it has not been around for a very long time at all. Right? DNA was discovered, the race for the double helix, so long we just had the 50th anniversary. So the fact that there was anything called DNA, right, the words DNA did not make it to anyone's vocabulary until a little over a half century ago. Again, if we're talking 9/11, it would be less than a half century. That was step number one. The concept that DNA could be used as a form of forensics to identify perhaps a criminal, the concept that was a possibility, the first paper where somebody raised the issue did not appear until 1985. Right? The fact that anybody had this idea that there's a certain amount of DNA that is different from every individual, sort of a super fingerprint that can be picked up, that concept did not exist until the mid-80s. So therefore, even talking 2001, that's a very new technology. It's a technology that's been in existence for 16 years, and it's a technology that is constantly improving itself. Meaning that the amount of work that we can do on the DNA nowadays is far beyond what we were able to do 10 years ago, And needless to say, it was far, far beyond what was being able to, one could do 10 years before that. I'll just note for the record that when we talk about the 9/11 victims and what do we have currently, got some seats in the back. We have one over here now. We're constantly being retested as the technology gets better. There are still memos coming into the Beis Din of new identifications. And this is almost 10 years later. Not so much that they're finding new bone fragments, which a few years ago happened, a nice chunk was found, but more so because the technology gets better. The ability to identify the DNA in the bone fragments, mostly what they have, improves. The technology gets better. The ability to identify gets better. So when we talk about DNA in 2001, right, we're talking a very, very new technology. Now, if one would have to look at technologies that are most similar to DNA technology, probably the most similar technology at the time would be blood tests. Now, let's remember, why would a Beis Din be using DNA evidence? So there are a slew of reasons why a Beis Din would want to use the DNA evidence, not different than reasons that a typical court would want to use DNA evidence, right? One is all the CSI reasons, right? If you can get, if can you convict someone on a crime? Right? Let's say there's a murder, and I find some blood, I find some hair, and I positively match the DNA. What would a Beis Din do with that information? So we could have civil cases, right? Yeah. Or criminal that are not capital cases, let's say. Right? A robbery case. Right? You dust for fingerprints, you dust for DNA. What would a Beis Din do with that? The major issue that DNA comes up with, believe it or not, is paternity cases. Now, not as much in America, more so in Israel. Remember in Israel, this is an area of great contention, all of it. And therefore all divorce cases and everything that goes along with a divorce case. It is not uncommon to have a case that sounds something like this. Husband and wife is divorcing, the wife is suing for alimony and child support. The husband says, I'm absolutely willing to pay support of all my children. However, I am not convinced that these are all my children. And therefore, I hereby agree to submit to a DNA test. In the event that this child is my child, I absolutely accept my duty to support it. However, if this child is not my child, I'm pretty upset with my wife to start with. I'm equally upset at whoever the father of this child is. And there's no way of living it that I'm going to support their kid. Now, what do you do with that information? So let's play out. Let's say the guy's right. I'm sure in a certain percentage of the cases he is right. So what have we proven now? We have proven that this couple has been married for the last 10 years. They have a 5-year-old child. And a 5-year-old child, this is not the father. What is the status of that child? In all likelihood, that child is what we would call a mamzer. Right? A mamzer is somebody who is born out of a union where the people who partook of the union would be basically liable for the death penalty, or kares, which is something similar to that, right? This woman was a married woman. Having a relationship with anyone other than her husband is liable for the death penalty. It makes the top 10 commandments, that is. And as such, this child's status would be that of mamzer. Status of mamzer, thankfully, doesn't happen that often, right? These types of cases, in Israel in particular, happen a lot. So in terms of history, going back, before there was DNA, there were blood tests. And before jilted husbands were running around saying, you know, I demand a DNA test, they were demanding blood tests. And the question came up, would it be possible to rely on a blood test in a Beis Din? Right? Basically, a blood test is there a limited amount of types, right? Certain types could beget other types can't. Right? What if we take a blood test and we find that there's no way that someone with the father's blood type could have a child with this blood type? What would that prove? Believe it or not, or maybe you do believe it, is that the initial reaction to these tests were very negative. Rabbi Ben Zion Chayuziel, who was the Rishon LeZion, I think the first Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, writes that these tests are rejected. We do not accept this type of test because it's against the Torah. Against the Torah. We're 613 of them, none of them say you can't take a blood test. what is against the Torah? So there's a famous Gemara in Nida, which makes the following comment. Everyone knows the first half of it. The first half goes like this, that there are three partners when it comes to a child. There is the mother, the father, and God. The Gemara is that I'm sure most people are familiar with. Part two people are less familiar with. They say, well, what does each of them give? Ah, he has his mother's eyes. What exactly does he have from his mother? So among the things you get from your mother is your blood. A quaternity. Because the father didn't give the blood. The mother gave the blood. And believe it or not, there was a fair amount of support for this approach. That support did not go as far as the Ashkenazic chief rabbi. The first chief rabbi of Herzog said, it's ridiculous. You're burying your head in the sand. Now, sociologically worth noting that Uziel, I'm pretty sure, did not have a college education. I did most of the people on one side. Rav Herzog had a PhD from the University of Dublin. So obviously his approach to science was somewhat different. And at the time he said, you know, this is undeniable. It's a fact. You know, is the Gemara to be taken literally or allegorically? Is the Gemara just dealing with wrong science? Now there's an ongoing discussion that goes back to the time of the Rishonim. When the Gemara makes a scientific statement, where does that come from? Is it a matter of the Gemara takes what is the common knowledge of the time and applies halacha to it? Or no, is it somehow this scientific knowledge is also divine given over to them? Now this is a famous discussion, particularly in the case of lice. The Gemara comments that you're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos. Why? Because it's not par of a rabbi. It does not, on its own, reproduce. That is what we would probably call, generally assumed, spontaneous generation. Something that's produced through spontaneous generation is not considered a living being. This is a discussion, and believe it or not, there are three possibilities. Yes, no, and maybe no. So here, the three possibilities are as far as one approach is to deny the science. Science is wrong. We have our Torah, that's all we believe. Now, believe it or not, that's not as ridiculous as it sounds. And if I wanted to defend that, I would get up and I would say, well, let's think about Pasteur. There was a general belief that mold, right, was produced spontaneously. He proved that it wasn't. Did he really prove that nothing is spontaneously reproduced? Right? He did not prove that. It's very hard to prove a negative. That's one approach. The other approach is, listen, they went to the rabbis of the Gemara. They told them, we have this animal that spontaneously reproduces, right? The top scientists of the day would swear on it. They say to them, if you have something that spontaneously reproduces, are you allowed to kill it on Shabbos? And they said, yes. Okay? The fact that the question that was asked was not a reasonable question in no way affects anybody. Right? It's not that the Gemara made a statement that we know that lice spontaneously generate. They say that we were told that the lice spontaneously generate, and since they spontaneously generate, therefore, if such is the case, you're allowed to kill it on Shabbos. That is approach number two. Approach number three is to say, we accept the science, however, we don't change the law. How would that work? It would work like this. The assumption is that the Gemara has a tradition that you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. The Gemara posited that the reason that you're allowed to kill a louse on Shabbos is because it's spontaneously generated. It is not the right explanation. However, the underlying law, the underlying tradition that you can kill a louse remains.
But that defies logic.
What?
But logically, that's erroneous.
Why?
You study formal logic. If A implies B, then the absence of A implies the absence of B. Period.
No. Again, if you turn around to me, if you tell me that birds fly, and I explain to you, well, the reason birds fly is because they're full of helium. If you disprove the fact that birds are full of helium, they're still flying.
Right.
Right? So to here, I know that I can kill lice on Shabbos.
You know.
I offer an erroneous reason. But just because my reason is erroneous does not change the underlying fact. The birds are still flying, and the lice can still be killed on Shabbos. Yes?
Well, and you're adding another factor. You're adding the factor that halacha is sacred. It's the same thing when it comes to kidneys. We don't now sell it in massive markets where grains might be combined, but we still, if you're Ashkenazi,
that's tradition. That's not a
halacha.
That's a big difference than Chilul Shabbos.
But still, both halacha and minhag, they're
Right,
which
but
doesn't have to be logical.
But again, so think about it. This is fascinating because the people that are denying science are the Mekilim here. If you deny science, I'm allowing you to kill ice on Shabbos. If you accept science, I'm putting you to death for that. Right? So it's a little unclear who's wearing the white hats and the black hats here. Right? The good guys and bad guys, if you think about it, said it, were they just repeating that which was the thought of the day, which of course likely was wrong. Right? I think we could say with a fair amount of certainty that your blood comes from your mother and your father equally. Right? This concept that it comes almost solely from your mother. Or perhaps the Lord never meant it. So you have this machlokas going on between the two chief rabbis. The Ashkenazic chief rabbi wanted to accept it. The smarter chief rabbi did not want to accept it. And this went on for some time. And even in the early 80s, Rabbi Avadia Yosef was of the opinion that you could not take this type of evidence, blood type evidence, to prove paternity one way or the other. Now, one has to keep in mind there was a good reason not to. Because what would accepting the evidence do for us, and what would rejecting the evidence do for us? Accepting the evidence would cause people to be mamzerim, which is not an outcome that anybody wants to see, right? To the extent possible, if there is a mamzer that nobody knows about, we just keep it quiet and let it go away. We do not try to encourage this type of thing. So therefore, by denying the science, they were in fact successfully stopping children from getting the status of mamzer. So there is a reason why you would want to stick your head in the sand. However, that all turned in 2001. I don't think anyone needs to know the story of 9/11, but the Bazin's involvement, we'll just say a few words. Many people got up in the morning, went to work that day, without anybody really realizing what happened to them thereafter, at 8:46. Now, 8:46 is about the time when people are getting to work, hanging up their coats. So very few people at that point will have called home, will have sent out an email, etc. So you had a situation where, you know, a person said goodbye to his wife at 7 o'clock in the morning, got on a bus, got on a train, and was just never heard from again. And there has to be some form of proof in order to let the woman remarry. Now, initially, a lot of people have the reaction which says, what else do you think happened to them? Wake up and smell the coffee, you know? The guy worked in the World Trade Center. He went there every day, you know? Millions of people saw the second one live on TV. He was on that floor. That's where he works. What do you think happened? It's unfortunate, but history proves this wrong. Just going back to 1995, to the bombing of the Jewish agency in Argentina, there were at least three cases of women, of people that claimed to be victims, who were found to be lying. All interesting cases. The first case was a fellow who called in and said the fine person is dead, and he himself had a psychological issue, and he called himself in as dead. Right? The second was a situation of a woman whose husband had walked out 2 years ago, who never gave her a get, who called in that her husband was there for, that's for the end of it. They'll pronounce him dead, and she'll be free like this. Within the first 6 months after 9/11, there were 80 arrests for 9/11 fraud. People trying to collect on life insurance policies when they, in fact, had not met the prerequisite of being dead. So there are reasons why people would do this. And it's unfortunate and it's disgusting, but it happens. So therefore, it becomes necessary to investigate each individual case and, to the extent possible, prove that the person was there. And, you know, we'd love to find out that it didn't happen. Right? Unfortunately, we do not have any of those cases. You know, we've got good news and bad news. Here he is. But it became necessary to investigate each case to the extent possible and render decisions for the relevant spouses. In terms of big numbers, there were 15 cases overall that went to the various Beis Dins across America to deal with. With the Beis of America, got 10 of them, two-thirds of the load. Now, again, what is defined as cases? It's defined as people that were Jewish, that were married, and either the spouse or somebody who is closely related we're concerned enough to ask about it. Right? I remember after 9/11 receiving many phone calls from different organizations, etc., trying to get a number of the amount of Jews that were involved and perished. We did not have that information. We can't even guess it. We only have a very small slice. I can tell you how many married people were Jewish and cared enough to go through the process. Right? That's all we can tell you. I don't know how many single people there were. I don't know how many unaffiliated Jews there were. That's all we can tell you. But it became eminently obvious that this was going to be cases like no one had seen in history before. Because the type of proof that was going to come forward will undoubtedly be proof that was never, ever tried in a Beis Din. Let's leave DNA aside for a second, but let's talk about other technologies, right? Email. A person sent out an email at 8:42 saying, "I'm at my desk." What does that prove? Now, most people have email, I imagine. Most people have email through their work. And most people can connect through their office email wherever they are in the world. I spend an entire summer in Denver pretending I'm in New York. Right? I get email, my voicemail comes through on my laptop, people call me, I call them back. None the wiser, right? Use my cell phone as a New York exchange on it. So what does it prove? Does an email prove anything? Well, it depends. You have to understand there's different types of email setups. They're secure and non-secure, right? Non-secure means I can log on wherever I want. Secure means I have to be sitting at that desk to do it. So therefore, it became necessary whenever you got a case of email to get someone who's intimately knowledgeable with the email system and the computers of the various workplaces and to sit down with them and say, listen, all this gibberish, right? You always get an email that says to, from, and then like a whole bunch of things. You get 10 per mile, right? Cell phone towers gives you a basic idea. You were nearest to this tower, but it doesn't really tell you how close you were. If you did it with downtown Manhattan, which is somewhat densely populated, every single block has a cell phone tower. So therefore, if you get records of someone's cell calls, you'll know within the block where they were. Now, it's very interesting, I'll just note, that in the first case we tried to use this, we had somebody who had a cell phone call at 8:53 to his wife. She claimed that it said, "I'm in the building, I'll call you back when I find out what's going on." And that was the end of it. That cell phone was routed through Secaucus, New Jersey, which raised some eyebrows. Now, of course, afterwards we found out that the reason was because the largest cell phone tower in Manhattan was on top of the World Trade Center. Once that got knocked out, automatically they started routing the phone calls wherever they could. Right, for the first few minutes, but they still were able to, after a few minutes, they totally lost it. They were able to maintain connections for a little bit thereafter, and therefore, that which we thought would be great, here's an opportunity to track people, that didn't work. But I mean, there's so many other forms of technology which came into play here. I mean, think about it. Mass media being what it is, how many articles were written in the week after 9/11 interviewing survivors? There were literally thousands of articles just talking to people. The people, if you lived in this town, they spoke to you in the town, they had general articles. How many articles were out there, right? Both the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune decided they were going to write an article about every single victim. I worked here and I saw so-and-so, and I told him I'm going down, and he said I'm going to stay here. So it was necessary to plow through thousands of articles. On the other hand, plowing through thousands of articles isn't such a big deal nowadays. You put LexisNexis together with Google, and you can just put in the names that you're looking for and on a daily basis get a report what's out there. So automatically, the technology was such that it became clear that these were going to be cases like no other cases. Now, that being said, so the Beis Din picked three or four judges to handle most cases. I got picked, not because I'm the biggest Talmud Chacham, stretch of imagination, but because I was the youngest member of the Beis Din. And the crack I made earlier was believed that whoever's the youngest probably knows how to use the computer and probably understands how all of this works. And therefore, that's how it all began. So, the issue of DNA automatically was going to become very important very early. So So let's just throw out a case or two, just to give examples of how things work. Little background to DNA evidence. We all have DNA. 99.9% of our DNA is all the same. But thankfully, we have so much DNA that 0.1% is an awful lot. 0.1% is around 3 million strands, shall we say. Now, there are different spots on the DNA where people have different DNAs, and by and large, we don't. And this DNA is, so we assume, distributed randomly. So if me and Scott went and we took a DNA test, swabbed our cheeks, and at one of these places we matched, the odds of that happening would be 10 to 1. Matching in two places becomes 100 to 1. Matching in 13 to 16 places, which is what we're dealing with, becomes a heck of a lot. Right. And what by a heck of a lot, again, so 10 to the 13th is 10 trillion. 10 trillion is not just more people than there are in the world. It's much more than all the people in the world that have ever existed from the time of creation. So if the odds are 10 trillion to 1, I don't care if the glove fits. There's a pretty good chance. Now, what is the level of certainty that you need halakhically in this case? Echad mine elef. One in 1,000, 99.9% sure. You have to be 99.9% sure that you got it right. Okay? If you're 99.9% sure you got it right, you're okay. In order to do a identification, the chief medical examiner of New York's office decided they wanted to be sure to the extent of 1 billion to 1, which is more. And in fact, I remember a meeting we had somewhat regular meetings with the chief medical examiner's office, who took a great interest in this, because, yeah, remember, this is a new technology, and they want it accepted. They don't want to be identifying people and have some rabbis going around saying, no, they got it wrong. They don't need this. So they were meeting with us pretty regularly. They were very open, you know. They opened with their labs. They were open with their information. And they have, let's say you have one that's on a mere 200 million to 1. So you're not going to release it, but would you mind telling us? We might be happy enough for taking like a 200 million to one as well. They basically said that, you know, they have methods of bumping it up that last little bit, if that's what it comes down to. So don't worry, you're not going to have any of those. So the way it works is you have these different loci, as they're called, and what we try to do is we try to get a piece of DNA of the person, and therefore, once we have the DNA of the person, we go and we match the DNA to this fragment, and if it matches, this fragment belongs to this person, and with that, we have a match, we have proven something. Now, there was a lot of discussion as to what did we prove. Let's say I find a finger, and the finger matches the toothbrush that was given in. So let's say I accept DNA, and this proves that this is his finger. How do I know he's not running around someplace with 9 fingers? Mm-hmm. Right? People can live without a finger. That's interesting, so we had discussed it, so I came in contact with jobs that you'd never even heard of. So the first person I had a long conversation was a fellow in the University of California, Berkeley, named Charles Brenner. Charles Brenner is a forensic mathematician. It took me a long time to figure out what that means, forensic mathematician. I've heard of forensic accountants. I know what they do. You know what I mean? There's a missing number. Charles, where's the number? What comes after 13? We have a 50. What a forensic mathematician does, and Charles, in fact, is the father of forensic mathematics, and he sells the program, but in a way that you cannot adjust it in any way. And in fact, there's a lot of complaints among the people who buy it, is that it's like basically written in WordStar. They said it's like it's an interface from 20 years ago. You know, they keep on nudging him, but he's very protective of it. And in fact, at the time, the New York chief medical examiner office re-upped, and among the things in their contract is he had to put a copy of the code in a safe, that if he should die, someone should know what to do with it. He was the only person in the world who had this. This person was very helpful to explain to us exactly what it means. You know, what do these numbers mean? When does it count, etc.? Another thing which became very important to us is, so basically, what it said, I read a book. And the book says, they got your client on DNA evidence, how do you get out of it? A legal book. And it goes like this. You be the expert. I'll be the judge. I'll be the lawyer. So tell me, you say that the odds of this being random is 15 billion to 1. Is that what you testified?
Yes. A little out of the jury.
in your laboratory, they're probably pretty good, right? You usually don't make mistakes, hardly ever, right? What are the odds of making a mistake? Million to one? One in a million, you'd say, that they make mistakes? More than that, or that's a good number? What would you say? Million to one. So the odds of this being a mistake and it not being my client is a million to one. But you said 15 billion. 15 billion is 15,000 times the size of a million. So you exaggerated the odds of my client being guilty by 15,000 times. The odds of my client being guilty, I rest my case. Right? So, that's what they get for hiring a real estate guy to do their scientific testimony. So, the limiting factor, really, in DNA evidence is the quality of the lab. Right? The one thing that you've got to be most concerned, the numbers are so overwhelming if you have a direct match that it's impossible to get around it. However, if there is a problem with the lab, then of course everything goes different.
So
now,
you run it in a second lab, and now you're talking in the...
So, but this is what happened in practically 9/11. 9/11, the Chief Medical Examiner's Office used three different sites. One in Utah, one in Albany, and one down south someplace. I don't remember what the third one was. And what they did is as follows. All the toothbrushes and the like got sent to one lab, where they did the DNA sequencing. That's all they did. And they put that in the database. All the bone fragments went to another lab, where they did DNA sequencing, and they put it in the database. And then the third possibility, the third lab, was just matching them up. So there is zero possibility of cross-contamination. Now, in the event that there was a lab error, the odds of a lab error leading to a match, what could have gone wrong? There's only one thing that could go wrong that could lead to a false positive. The only thing that could go wrong that would lead to a false positive is if Mr. Schwartz gave it a toothbrush and they write Williamson on it. Right? That's the only way you can get a false positive.
Or if they both got toothbrush or they both got bone.
What?
Instead of one getting toothbrush and one getting bone, they both got DNA from the toothbrush.
Well, yeah,
they both got DNA from the bone.
No, but if you're sending all the toothbrushes to Utah and all the bones, that's not going to happen. If a bone shows up here, I know
so
something...
So the extraction was done at the local lab.
Right. Like, all they did was the intake in the hand. They labeled everything, shipped half it there, right? So that couldn't have happened. The only thing that could happen was that on the intake, they could take it. Now, of course, there are definitely ways of doing belt and suspenders here. There's something called kinship analysis, right? Kinship analysis means as follows, right? The person has two parents, right? When it comes to these types of DNA, they have numbers, right? So it's a double helix, it's a strand. At any point, there's two pieces, shall we say, okay? They all get numbers. Let's say the father's a 1-2 and the mother's a 3-4, right? The kid could be a 1-3, a 1-4, a 2-3, or a 2-4, because the mother gives one and the father gives one, right? The kid can't be a 2-8. He can't be a 2-5, right? That can't happen.
Unless there's non-paternity.
What?
Right.
I see. If it's the mother and if it's the father,
no.
That can't be. So, putting that together. Knowing that that can't be, right? Just having the parents, it limits it, right? Let's say it limits it by a quarter. Instead of knowing exactly one, you know four, but it's something less, right? And you do that times 13 to the 13th power, the number ends up being a lot. When we have numbers this big and you divide them by numbers that big, you still have pretty big numbers. So kinship analysis, in most cases, work as well. So that's how I went about. So I brought with me today to make an actual case where I did not give anything enough, but we do have Sim Calabrino for those who don't get these. Which is, I whited out the case, but this is one of the 9/11 cases, and give you an idea of how it exactly worked. Here's how it goes. So I'll hold it up here. Smart air. And basically the way it goes is as follows. On top you have here, that's probably one of four sheets. That's okay. It's a good one. So So basically what you have here is as follows. You have a victim intake sheet, where this was done at the time, and they point out this is the name of the victim, these are the relevant numbers, and this is the reviewer. And they say how we checked it and how we double checked it. Now moving down to the relevant part, you've got the box over here, which says what they have. So they have, first is what's called case 829, which is a swab, meaning that somebody swabbed the inside of their cheek to provide DNA that was brought in, and something that was unknown. In this case, the maximum you can get of DNA is 14 spots. Obviously, in the cheek swabs, they got all 14. They found no DNA on the hair. They found no DNA on the toothbrush, but they found 13 on the unknown. And therefore, they're going to make a match between these bone fragments that were found. In this case, by the way, there's an entire rib cage that was found. It was a very large piece, right? And the matches. Now, if you take a look, if you turn the, now again, just looking at the back, is the second half of that sheet, which says we've made the victim, were there any problems, etc. Now, if you look at the very bottom of it, it tells you what the unknown is. The unknown person is a Hebrew card that gave 13 loci. The profile on the Hebrew card could not come from the offspring of these two parents. The pedigree works, I'm okay. What does that mean? It means that we had a very odd case here. What you had is that the DNA matched the parents' DNA, but the DNA did not match the card. They asked us to come down to identify the card. I went down to do it, and it was one of these Hamsas. Those are the Sfaradi. Obviously, you carry this for good luck. Seems he didn't have it that day. They brought it in. They were able to get some DNA off of it. The DNA did not match the parents' DNA. Now, let's take a look at this sheet over here. This is the actual sheet where the matching is done. If you look at it going across, on top, you have the likelihood, okay, of this being random. In this case, four. And it has here there's three different DNA points they could get. This is the DNA of the bones. BF stands for biological father. BM is biological mother. So, looking across the board here, you'll note that in almost all cases there are two numbers. First 15-18, 16-17. Sometimes there's only one number. What one number means, it's the same number twice. So, if you look at the first one, okay, this is the bottom of the letter, the father is a 15-18, the mother is a 15-17. That means the offspring has to be a 15, right? Let's get one from each. So again, this child got the 15 from the mother, the 18 from the father, that's a match. Next one, the mother is a 16-17, the father is a 16-16. The child is a 16-16, it got a 16 from both. Match. Going across, 20-21, 21-23, it's a 20-21. That means I got 20 from one, I got 21 from the other one. Across the board, you'll note that every single one is a kinship match. Meaning that, in this case, 14 for 14, you're able to get them all. There was a complete match based on kinship analysis. Meaning that if this is the mother and this is the father, is the comparison of the DNA of the Chamsa together with the DNA found. This is not a match. Right? If you start looking across the board, you'll see that many of them, going back to the last sheet, do not at all add up. Right? That which this is showing could not possibly be the children of those parents. So what do? We have a machlokas here. On the one hand, kinship analysis says that it is the parent. On the other hand, you have this item which was brought in by a friend in the family saying that the DNA on this is this person's DNA. One matches, one doesn't match. What would you say?
But the Chamsa could have been handled by many people.
Clearly, not it could have been, it had to be.
Right.
Because the Chamsa could not, whoever handled it, forget
it,
right, could not have been the child of these parents.
Right.
The DNA is the child of these parents. Right? So therefore, they write here, note the copy previously received, the circle number, right, dot, dot, dot. As you'll see, several alleles, that means the place, are the same as his parents, but not both at every single there. Therefore, this does not have the DNA from any of the parents. Right? So therefore, based on this, the report came into the basement that we have successfully identified this person, and we are willing to say that this person has passed on, and here is the evidence. Right? We received these with basically every case. Whenever they found DNA, they would send us the report, or we would come down and see the report. I remember one time, Rabbi Reese, who's now the Dean of Reitz, at the time was head of the Beis Din. His involvement in this was the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, and therefore, Rabbi Willig and I were the ones who tended to go down and do these visits. I remember one time when they had a case where they said, we have a shoulder blade and a little bit of a rib cage. They said, would you like to see it? And I said, that would be necessary. Rabbi Willig said, what, you afraid? I'm not afraid. So I said, okay, we'll look at it. It ends up that there was a problem they couldn't get to. I said, it's a sign. You're supposed to look. Should be peeking. All right. So as this was going on, one of the rules, going back to Aguda issues, is there was an agreement from the very beginning that every case that was going to come forward, to the extent possible, we want to make sure that every Beis Din is agreeing on it. If there is a Beis Din that's going to go out and say this woman can remarry, and then there'll be another Beis Din that she can't, this doesn't do her a lot of good. Because she'll get remarried, and some people will say her children are fine, and some people say her children will be mamzerim. And you probably don't want to get involved with people that might be mamzerim. So therefore there was an agreement that even though not all Beis Dins get along all the time, we're going to sit down, we're going to have a meeting, we're going to get some agreement on this. And that agreement has to be both within America and beyond, particularly Israel. So the issue of whether DNA evidence will be accepted became a very big deal. Now remember, Israel's the general rule in Israel was not to accept it. Why? Well, part of it was practical. The practical effect is we don't want to make mamzerim. That's fine, but now you got to think. So we had a meeting at the nearest shul to the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, so all the kohanim could come as well. And they made a presentation. They said, okay, this is what we're doing, this is what we're having, you're all welcome to come down and visit the labs, which we actually did. It's interesting, at the time, so Rabbi Wilg and I would go down to a lab, you could tell us whatever you want. You know, they could show us like a soft ice cream machine and say, oh, this is a major century. Oh, yes, I do. What do I know about this? You could pass off anything on me.
Take your wife.
So Rabbi Wilg said, so you have to take your wife. My wife would also fall for it. She's theoretical. my wife would be nodding with the rest of us. But thankfully, it was a girl in Stern who worked on the genome project. Her knowledge was somewhat good. We had a guy from YU also who had spent a lot of time in the lab. So we told him we're gonna bring our experts with us also. Thankfully, our yeshiva produces the type of people that we could bring down for this. And we went through it, and it's really the best. And we spoke to people in Israel. They said, yeah, there's nothing like you, like the New York Chief Medical Examiner's office. You know, they get a lot of business there. You get good at it after a while. So we have this meeting, and basically they explain that there are these 13 points, and at any of these points, the odds of it being are, shall we say, 1 in 10 or beyond most cases, and therefore you add it up mathematically. So one of the Beis Dins, Matt Hours, got up and said, well, what does this prove? If you look at one of them, so it's 1 in 10. Okay, that's really, if you tell me that 9 out of 10 this woman's husband is dead, that's not enough for me. If you do that for me twice, again, twice you did tell me that's not enough. Now, 13 times you did something that's not enough for me to be convinced. So that's a total lack of understanding of mathematics. You get it right. The second digit is 1 in 10, you're going to get it right. 1 in 10 is not that good. But the fact that you were able to rattle off the entire Social Security number, in fact, Rabbi Shlomo put it better. He said, how do I know this is Scott Friedman? Well, I know Scott Friedman. He's around this tall, and he has these types of glasses, and he has that type of beard. Identification, right, definition is involved, right? There are a lot of people that are as tall as Scott Friedman, a lot of people that have similar beards, a lot of people that wear similar glasses. But when you add it up together, that makes an identification. Right? If I got up in court and I said, I know John F. Kennedy, and that is John F. Kennedy, right? So you wouldn't say, well, how do you know? Of course, I see him, I know, I talk to him, I know. Yes, there are the people that sound like him, the people that look like him, the people of the same height, but you put it all together, that is what an identification is. So the fact now that we're breaking it down into basic pieces does not make it any worse. So there was a meeting, and eventually there was an agreement that at this point DNA is accepted across the board by all, but they didn't. Probably curious what happened to the mamzers. So what we raised at the time, which I think is the assumption, is that what I said earlier is 100% true. If a woman has a child, not from her husband, during the time of marriage, that's not a good thing. We don't support it. However, that child is not necessarily a mamzer. There are situations where the child will not be a mamzer. For example, not likely, but possible nonetheless, what if that... Similarly, if she's with a non-Jew and they have a child, that child's also not a mamzer. So the fact that the mere fact that this person is able to prove that he's not the father does not logically lead to the fact that this kid's a mamzer. So the approach in the Beis Din will be as follows now. The guy comes forward and he says, I want you to take a DNA test, I'm going to prove it. The guy takes the DNA test and he does prove it. The assumption is, as far as monetary cases go, DNA is enough. We will accept DNA evidence and therefore he does not have to pay child support. However, we will not say that this child is a mamzer. We do not accept it because it does not prove the case. Right? There are still possibilities otherwise. So that's the assumption, and surprisingly, I'd say, there was a much higher percentage of Beis Din cases that ended up with DNA than the general population. It's very interesting. The role DNA played in 9/11 was tremendous. I'll just give you one example. So remember that we had this trial of this guy, Zachariah? Zachariah was the 19th... terrorist? 16th terrorist, right? There's a guy, Zachariah Moussaoui.
Didn't get on the plane.
Right? And why did they say that each plane had four of them?
They weren't calling him Zachariah.
No, they weren't calling him Zachariah. So we all did. Right? So Zachariah Moussaoui. So he was, how do they know? They said each plane had five terrorists, but the one that was in the Pentagon only had four terrorists. How do you know that? Who told? There are no survivors in the plane. Right, there wasn't a roll call on the plane where all the terrorists said hello. How do you know that there were only four? One guy didn't get on the plane. So the way you know is that they played down, but it was nothing like the World Trade Center. I mean, the World Trade Center, you had a case where a plane plows in, the thing blows up, and then 110 stories falls on it. So when it came to the Pentagon, where you didn't have this, they were able to positively identify every single victim. There was not one victim of the Pentagon that the remains were not identified. And in fact, when they were done, they still had four victims that they couldn't identify. Not only did they do the whole list, but they had more than they needed. So they sat there scratching their heads and saying, you know, what's going on here? We've identified everyone, so who are these people? And it dawned upon them that the families in Saudi Arabia never delivered their toothbrushes. Right? Obviously, they found the terrorists as well, and they did not have corroborating evidence. And that's how they knew there were only four of them. And that's how they knew that the one was missing. Because the DNA evidence in a more normal case where a mere 200, 300 people die, right, is that much less than the other one. The 9/11 cases live on, you should know. As I said, there are still a lot of unidentified bone fragments. The fact that they identified as much as they did was miraculous. I mean, think about it. You know, the heat that was involved in this, you know, the weight that came crushing down. I mean, we had a case, I mentioned it last year, which was a heart-wrenching. Two people said, I know him. I didn't see him in the office. I was there. I didn't see him. Right? Didn't log on, didn't phone call. We had nothing on this guy. Until finally we were able to, with the help of USA Today, which actually were very helpful to the Beis Din in a lot of the work that we did, we had a partnership with them, came through and showed us that basically if you took his desk and you painted a bullseye on it, that's where the plane came through. He's on the north side of the 95th floor of the North Tower. So they said, you're not going to find anything on this guy. And what it took to come up with anything, I mean, just briefly, what happened was eventually our first major breakthrough was we found this guy was an environmentalist. How is that a breakthrough? So I don't know if you people are familiar with the New York Mass Transit Authority, but we have something called Metro Cards. swipe your MetroCard, walk through the turnstile. When you're done with your MetroCard, what do you do with it? Throw it away.
Reuse it.
What? Right. Most people throw it away.
Put more money on it.
But if you're a real environmentalist and you don't want to throw it away, you can put more money on it. This guy has had the same MetroCard for the last 6 months. Okay? We get his credit card statement. Through the credit card statement, we're able to identify which MetroCard he's using. The MetroCard system cycles 10 times an hour, which means within 6 minutes you can tell when someone went through. Okay? This is a person who got up every morning in Teaneck, New Jersey, took a bus down to 42nd Street Port Authority, got on a train, and took the train to the World Trade Center. Okay? The last time his MetroCard was used, it proves that he got on the bus, which was interesting because no one saw him on the bus out of Jersey. It proves that he went into the train station. It does not prove that he got on a train. It did not prove that he got on a downtown train. It did not prove that the train got there on time. It did not prove that he got out of the train and went straight to his office. But this is already a step. This is our first major breakthrough, right? So you have a question halachically. If every morning the guy gets up and does A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C, D, E, and one morning he does A, B, C, can we assume D and E? So that was step number one. Step number two is, well, how long does it take a train to get there? Now, those of you who are familiar with this, with the transit system, A and E, express. C is local. It gets on the C, it takes longer. You get on the A, it lets you off 3 blocks away. The E takes you into the World Trade Center. Right? What was the next train? Well, how long would it take? How long did it take on an average day? Step number two is to figure out, well, what can we do about this? Ends up that the World Trade Center had the most advanced security of any office building for sure, and much more than even governmental buildings. Remember, 1993 was bombed. And afterwards, they sunk around $80 million at least into security. It is generally believed, even though they will deny it, it's inevitably true, that whenever you swiped in the morning with your ID, they took a picture of you. And therefore, there was a database with pictures of every person that went in. And even if I have to make a pizza delivery, they know you lent out your card, and for that, you'd be punished. The punishment was they would take away your ID, and you'd have to sign in every morning for the next week or the next month, depending on the time they caught you.
They used to do that in MTA also.
What?
Yeah, they
take away the elevator pass. So this was the holy grail of this search. If you could find the database with the picture of every person who went in, well, I guess that's the end of the story. What? Of course, they had the good sense to keep it at the bottom of the building, was where the database was. And after several weeks, they finally got to it, and there was no way they could get any information out of it. It was utterly destroyed. However, there was a backup in Paterson, New Jersey. And they backed up once a month, which meant that I would not be able to get my information for September 11th. But I could have all the July and August I wanted, which was very important. Because now, if I put my MTA information together with my World Trade Center, I know exactly how long it takes him from the minute he swipes in to the train until he walks into the building. And with that, we can do it. And it came with the range. It happens to be that we had a lot of difficulty giving it. The Trade Center, the Port Authority was in charge, refused to give it over. They had two reasons for it, they told us. One was privacy concerns, the second being security concerns. We told them that they're both kind of weak. The family has signed over their rights. Hey, there's no right. We have the rights to the privacy. And security for what? You have a hole in the ground. It's over. There's nothing to secure anymore, boys. So we had a lot of difficulty. It's a good story how we finally got it. So we went to the highest levels of government, the General Counsel of the Port Authority, to give this to me. Right? All I need is a secretary to look it up and say, here's what it says. I'll happily take her aides. All I need is to find one firm person who works for the Port Authority, who I can explain what I'm doing here, that'll be willing to do this for me. So how are you going to find a firm person in the Port Authority? So in New York, we have something called the Aguda Minyan Map, which tells you where there's a mincha up and down Manhattan. So we did is they took the minion map, and we went to each and every office of the Port Authority. We started making phone calls to the nearest minchas. They said, anyone who comes to your minion who works in the Port Authority? We got a guy. We got the Associate General Counsel as a firm guy. We called him up and we said, here's what's going on. So I said, just read it to me. I said, I'll take your Adis, just read it to me, tell me what it says. He said, I'm the associate general counsel. Give me a minute. He walks into the general counsel's office. He says, this is all what they want. And with the next day, we had the whole thing. Right? So it ends up based on the information that this person got to his desk, it would seem between 8:38 and 8:43 on that day, which explained everything, which meant that he walked in, he hung up his coat, and it was over. There was no calling the client, there was no logging on. He had the absolute perfect worst timing. So the question is that enough? Later that week, we get a call. They found DNA evidence. They found two pieces of bone, two blocks away, out the other side of the building. He was literally hit and blown through the building, two blocks out. Once you had the DNA evidence, done. Every single case ended with the woman being allowed to remarry. I'll have you know, though, there is one case that bothers me to this day, where I'm sitting and waiting that we get the call that they found the DNA. The case was like this. Fellow works on the 87th floor of the South Tower. Okay? Plane came in, South Tower, 79th through 86th. Came in, remember, they come in on an angle, so they would say, hit as many floors as they can. Okay? Upon hearing the first crash, this person decides he's going to leave. The World Trade Center's 79th floor is a very important floor. It's called the Sky Lobby. If you wanted to get beyond the 79th floor, you had to take an elevator to the 79th floor, then switch elevators to go to a higher floor. Therefore, needless to say, the 79th floor was packed. Hundreds of people were on the 79th floor when the plane came through. We had testimony that there were people who got into an elevator, saw him stand on the outside of the elevator, took the elevator down, and as they stepped out, the building shook. Meaning they were on the last elevator that made it out, and they testified that he was there. Which seems to be a slam dunk. Meaning that either he didn't get off the floor, or he was on the floor in one of the elevators, which went afterwards, which got cut and came crashing down. We thought this was a slam dunk case until there was an article out of all places. I remember this information was given to us by a reporter in the USA Today, and he said, you want me to send you the article? I said, I can get it myself. He said, you sure? I said, yeah, I'm sure. So I went to the YU library, and I said, I'd like a copy of November's latest home journal. And they said, we don't carry it. I said, I'd like an interlibrary loan. They said, we don't usually do that. I said, but I'm faculty, and I want it. So begrudgingly they gave it to me. And as I filled the paper, I said, I couldn't hold myself back. I said, we just have the most wonderful recipe for peach cobbler. So the latest home journal identified 11 people who survived from that floor. An unbelievable fact. Because it came in on an angle, there was a flight of stairs that was unaffected. Nobody knew this at the time, but everyone could have escaped. The people on the 90th, 95th floor could have just taken these steps down and gotten out. And the way we know this is because there was a fellow on the 63rd floor who after the crash said, oh my goodness, I remember an MGM, I'm going to run to the roof and they'll get me from there. This guy runs up to the 94th floor and he said, wait a second, this is stupid. He turned around, he ran all the way down, and he got out. Right? Proving this guy ran through the crash area twice. Because it came at an angle, there were steps that were not affected. Unlike the North Tower, where on the 91st floor, nobody died. 92 above, nobody survived. A clean cut. It was not easy to do. These people were not healthy, by and large, and psychologically, they definitely did not want to revisit it. But with the help of the USA Today, we were able to get email addresses to the next of kin, and we said to them, we're dealing with victims as well. We need closure. Could you ask the following question? Did they see? And across the board, everyone said no. And the assumption, therefore, was, listen, yeah, this is a case of a guy who didn't make it. And this was the last case, and we were monitored. I must admit, if they would find DNA evidence of this guy, I'd feel much better. Yes? No, I mean, the terrorists were trying to get as many floors as possible and to go as low as possible. And that was the assumption. I don't think they had any specific ideas, and so they just got lucky on that one.
I'm sort of surprised how much DNA there was, because everything seemed to be so eviscerated. So the question is, without trying to be morbid, how much biological stuff was found?
An awful lot. I can tell you that of the I think there were about 2,700 victims, and they identified around 1,800 of those, around two-thirds, which is pretty impressive.
But you don't need large samples.
No, no, I know that, but everything seems to be turned to powder.
Right.
Except the
no,
paper. The paper flew for miles.
Right,
but
I'll tell you, you know, among the postscripts of it is the 9/11 memorial's opening this year. One of the original plans was to take the unidentified samples and put them in the memorial and taking them out as it's found, as that's where it should be. The Basin stepped in because that would have made it impossible finding it in a way that the tumor would stay in the case and not come out of it, and a Cohen would be able to go in as well. Just some of the less important but notable facts as well. So we hope never to use DNA evidence this way. It's here to stay.
Was there any discussion of resorting to
heteromere run? Does not work for women. Work for women. 14 out of 15 cases were women. One was a man who lost his wife. Heteromere run would not work in these cases.
You explain to people what a heteromere run
is. Okay. There's a concept as follows. So there, as we know, a woman cannot get remarried without a valid divorce. And nowadays meaning for the last several centuries, a man cannot get remarried without a valid divorce either. And according to the Torah, a woman cannot have two husbands. The Torah does provide for a woman, for a man to have two wives, however, for the last 700 years or so, but we haven't been doing that. That's rule number one, okay? Now, rule number two also is that woman can't force a man to divorce her, a man can't force a woman to be divorced, right? At this point, everything's on a pretty even keel. There is, however, since one is biblical in nature and one is rabbinic in nature, there is a concept called the heteromere rabbanim, meaning that if you have a very extreme circumstance, and these are very, very rare, right, then the man could be allowed to remarry, since technically on a biblical level he's allowed to, If the husband takes a get and puts it in escrow, and also puts in escrow enough money to support his first wife for the rest of her life, in such a case, we will allow what's called the heter meir rabbanim. But a heter meir rabbanim obviously will only work in a case where it's not biblical in nature, in the event that you have a situation where it's not the husband who's stuck, but the wife that's stuck, then that will not be an effective mechanism to get around it. But I'll just make one more note. There is an Israeli company called Nucleix.
Yeah.
Nucleix has found a way to forge DNA.
Yeah.
New York Times ran an article on it last summer. You name it, they can make the DNA for you. We'll have to see what that means in the long run.
Technology out of Israel, too? Yeah.
That's why Nucleix is an Israeli company.
Ah.
So, yeah. So that's it. What? Right. The question is, you've got to sit in the. Besides, at the bare minimum, the Basin has to be on top of technology. Because besides the Nucleix, besides selling the ability to make fake DNA, they also sell a kit which tells the difference between theirs and others. God bless those the technology. Right. So there you have an appropriate topic, unfortunately, for this time of year, and you know. Hopefully, we don't have to deal with this anymore. Thank you.